I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It's deja vu all over again in Pennsylvania, with the legislature and the governor still fighting about how to find $2.2 billion to fill a hole in the $32 billion spending plan for this fiscal year that began on July 1st. The House and Senate are controlled by Republicans, and they can't agree on where to find the money, so the stalemate continues into the third month. And just to add to the misery and the drama, yesterday, Standard & Poor's downgraded Pennsylvania's bond rating because of its unbalanced budget and use of one-time fixes. Our guest Philadelphia Daily News columnist John Baer had a suggestion recently. Send your legislator a rubber band for their wrist and tell them to snap out of it. He's a longtime observer of the political shenanigans and gamesmanship in Harrisburg. He's a regular on Radio Times. John Baer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Always a pleasure.
You got that rubber band ready?
All set.
When was the last time Pennsylvania passed a budget on time? Do you remember?
Oh, sometime in the 1930s, maybe.
Is that true?
No. Governor Rendell was famous for not signing budgets on time because he wanted what he wanted, and usually he got at least some of it. Tom Corbett signed some budgets on time, although there were some technical glitches. But Governor Wolf, so far, not yet.
Does it matter?
In the big scheme of things, no, except when you get into the arcane world of bond financing and things like that. Although, you know, for some context, Marty, I mean, that whole bond thing probably gets a little bit more shuddering than it ought to. I mean, the Standard & Poor's dropping Pennsylvania to what they call an A+. Standard & Poor's has like 10 different ratings for bonding, and A+ is right in the middle, so it's like the fifth out of 10. That's the good news. The bad news is there's only two states with a worse rating, New Jersey, of course, and hapless Illinois. But in terms of, I mean, the state can still borrow. It's not like we're going to be shut out of the borrowing market. But the problem is the lower you go on the rating, the more it costs you in terms of fees and interest.
So why is this so difficult this year? What's at stake?
You know, it's tough to say this year. I mean, we go through this, as you suggested, on a fairly regular basis. But to show you just how difficult it is, if you look at what has been done so far, just look at the votes. I mean, the Senate passed its package, which includes some taxes, and they did it with 26 votes, which is exactly what you need to pass it. When the House passed their thing without taxes, they did it with 103 votes, which is one more than you need. So even in these vastly different worlds, in each chamber, it's really tight. And the only thing so far that has been rejected or approved with a big number was the Senate vote just taken on the House package. That was tossed aside 43-7. So, and that's the no tax thing, which is a tough vote for a lot of Republicans, especially rural Republicans, who, you know, you say, hey, look, here's a budget plan that doesn't raise taxes, and you vote against it. That's tough for a primary next year.
So what kind of taxes are at least being considered to be raised, or even the possibility of new taxes? What's the Senate suggesting?
Well, what the Senate suggested was a long-sought severance tax on the extraction of natural gas, which has been a fight since the industry came to Pennsylvania. I mean, Ed Rendell tried to get it right away, and had we done so, you can make a case. Had he been successful, you can make a case we wouldn't be in this mess. So the Senate passed the severance tax, and to everyone's surprise, after saying they would not raise taxes either, the Senate, as you said, both chambers are Republican, they also passed taxes on things that people actually use, like your telephone, both your landline and your cell phone, raises the taxes on telephone service, raises the taxes on your electric bill, and raises the taxes on those people who use natural gas on the gas bill. So there's about, all told, half a billion dollars in taxes in the Senate plan. So listen, at some point during this process from May moving forward, every conceivable tax was at least discussed. But that's what's on the table right now. unless negotiators have moved past that and gone on to something else, which we don't know yet.
And I do want to get to the House. So we are looking for $2.2 billion. Is that correct?
Which is a big number,
no matter
where you live, right?
Exactly. So what is the House suggesting?
Well, the House is suggesting, first and foremost, no taxes, okay, on anything ever. And a little known secret is when people get all shuddery about having their bond ratings downgraded and saying, well, this will make borrowing tough. And states borrow money. Look, Pennsylvania was scheduled to borrow like $2 billion this year for all kinds of reasons. So when you say you're not going to be able to borrow, but here's the problem. In the Republican caucus in the House, I had one member tell me, when I raised this issue, isn't that a concern? This member said, look, you have to understand, a vast majority of the Republican House caucus doesn't want to borrow anything ever, so they don't care about bond ratings. So what the House has done, what the House passed, is a raid on so-called special funds. These are funds that are off budget, and they're pretty fat, so they want to get like $630 million out of that. They want to get $400 million out of what's called lapsed funds. Those are funds that every agency, every commission, every body has kind of, you know, they didn't spend it this year, so they keep recycling it. They want to get some transfer money. They, of course, have a dream thing of $225 million in gaming proceeds from God knows where. They haven't authorized any way to collect that. And on and on and on. And, of course, $1 billion in borrowing from the Tobacco Settlement Fund, which I guarantee everybody will lead to litigation.
Well, interesting. I do want to get to the gaming, but you're talking about something called off-budget accounts. So these what do these accounts pay for? What kind of services or programs are associated with these off-budget accounts?
Almost everything you can think of that's important to Pennsylvania.
Really?
These are funds that were established statutorily to be specifically designated to do specific things. A lot of them have to do with environmental things. But they are, for example, PennVest water pollution, PennVest drinking water, higher education assistance, Keystone Recreation Park Fund. The Environmental Stewardship Fund is a big one. And the Public Transportation Trust, which pays for mass transit, it is also a big one. And these funds, Marty, are in what is called the Common Investment Pool. And State Treasurer Joe Torsella, who I'll bet regrets this now, made these public when he became treasurer. He put them on his website in a transparent portal so that you can go in on any day and see how much money is in those funds. So what the Republican House did is, I guess, discovered this and said, holy cow, I mean, these funds, just take something called the Common Investment Pool, there is a total of like $2 billion plus in there.
Wow.
And a lot of this money is in reserve. Some of it is, you know, set aside for when it's needed. Some of it is kept in reserve. So they want to say, let's hit the reserves, maybe not hurt the programs, and we won't have to raise taxes.
Does that make some sense to you?
It makes partial sense. I have to believe when you're talking about that amount of money that there are reserves that can be tapped. Is it enough to avoid any kind of new revenue, steady revenue, tax income? Probably not. And it violates one of Governor Wolf's prerequisites, which I want funding to come other than a one-time source. We can't keep doing these one-time-only hits, which also makes a lot of sense.
Let's talk a bit about gambling. I do want to have a caller that I want to get in on the conversation before we say goodbye to you. As you said, the House looking for something like 220.
Wait, you have a caller? This is new.
We have a new story here. People are all excited.
I know how excited the public gets about the Common Investment Pool.
There's a whole history here between John and the callers from Radio Times. But let me ask you about gambling. And you're saying that the House is looking for something like $225 million for what, expanded gambling? We're going to have gambling everywhere
we
look?
We want gambling. We want more gambling. We want, you know, little what's called VGTs, video gaming terminals. VGTs to me sounds like something you need to take penicillin for. But, they want to put like 40,000 of these little machines in bars and taverns all over the state, which they say will bring in 300 million, 400 million, God knows what,
yeah.
Or create small casinos or allow the big casinos to put their own gaming, The point being is they'd like a whole lot of money, $300 to $400 million, but they haven't said or passed or proposed exactly how it's going
to
come in.
And they'd have to pass something in order to get these.
Not necessarily, Marty. Okay. I mean, one of the blessed tricks of budgeting at the state level and often used in Pennsylvania is if you put it in, on the books that you're going to get $220 or $225 million from something, you can spend that whether you get it or not. Which is why we have these deficits.
Let me get Elizabeth from media to join our conversation. Elizabeth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I just want to, I sort of am resenting the playful and hysterical attitude of how cute this is. And I just want to ask why our legislatures are getting paid when they're not doing their job. If they were the first people on the cut, I think we'd have a different outcome.
Well, we're not trying to be cute here, Elizabeth. This is a serious issue.
Not necessarily you, but it seems like it's all fun and games, you know, whereas, you know, I think bond ratings are important.
No, fair enough. It's a good point. Let me give John Baer a chance to respond. If they weren't getting paid, John, would that make a difference?
Well, Marty, you probably know, Elizabeth, when this is something I've written about virtually 10, 20 times, that yes, there ought to be an absolute rule that if you don't pass a budget on time and have it balanced, which we never do, you don't get paid, the executive branch doesn't get paid, and it's not that you don't get paid for the duration of however long the stalemate is, you don't get back paid either. If that was a law, believe me, things would pass on time. So Elizabeth is absolutely right on that. And on the bond issue thing, look, I said we have the third worst in the country. Only two states are worse as a bond rating. But because we're in the middle of the pack, something that is basically called upper medium grade is an A+. We still have the ability to borrow, so it's not going to shut the state down.
A minute before we have to say goodbye to you, what role is the governor playing, Governor Wolf playing, in these negotiations?
You mean the invisible man?
Well, I was wondering. I that was in the back of my mind. Is he the invisible man in Harrisburg?
The governor is now on a 14-county northern tier tour of Pennsylvania. He's also up for re-election next year. When the governor's polling numbers are bad is when he is publicly seen fighting with the legislature, because then he gets lumped in as part of the problem. When his numbers are good or stable, it's when he's not in the news. So somebody is giving him political advice. A lot of people are wishing that he would be much more involved in leadership.
And would it be fair to say that this is Southeast PA versus the rest of the state when it comes to this difference of opinion about the budget?
On many issues, it would be fair, particularly on the severance tax on natural gas, because natural gas is in the western part of the state, and that affects those communities and all the dollars associated with the industry. On some other things, not entirely. But if you look at the people who voted against the House-passed bill, they are from the Southeast.
Interesting. John Baer, as always, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Marty, always a pleasure. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And he writes the Baer Growls column for the Philadelphia Daily News. And after this very short break, we'll be talking about the Equifax website hack. We have two guests who will be joining us. Much more to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Last night, the Securities and Exchange Commission announced that its computer filing system called EDGAR had been hacked last year. The hacking, the SEC said, may have provided the basis for illicit gain through trading. Now, this is just days after the consumer credit reporting firm Equifax revealed that hackers stole personal and financial information from some 143 million people, things like social security numbers, addresses, birth dates, driver's license numbers. The research firm SSRS found that most Americans were concerned about the Equifax breach, but just 19% had done anything to protect their data. Today on Radio Times, we get an update on how hackers were able to infiltrate Equifax and what it reveals about how to safeguard our personal information. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Matt Blaze. He's Associate Professor for Computer and Information Science at the University of Pennsylvania. His research focuses on cryptography and secure systems design. Matt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us by telephone is Famina Rashid, and she's senior writer for CSO, focusing on the information security Security Beat. Famita, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And let me just give out information to our listeners, because I'm sure a lot of people will want to join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just begin at the beginning, and there's several beginnings here, but Matt, I'm looking at you here. Do we know how hackers were able to breach Equifax?
Well, we know something about it. There was some internal investigation done at Equifax, and actually, ironically, the report on that appears to have leaked out. So what appears to have happened is that Equifax operates web servers, some for the public, but also some for their customers, financial institutions and so on. And those web servers are the portal that their customers use to get the credit reports that Equifax maintains. And web servers are fairly complicated. They mm-hmm. can sometimes have security vulnerabilities in them. And what appears to have happened is that the attackers, whoever they are,
and we don't know that, right?
Exploited a vulnerability in one of the web servers that Equifax operates.
Famita, when you read something like 143 million Americans, and there are probably more people in other countries, could possibly have had this information stolen, that just seems almost overwhelming. Should we be nervous? Should we be afraid?
Well, the number, as you mentioned, is tremendous. I mean, I think we're talking about one third of the American population. I think if you are feeling nervous now, it feels a little late to the game. I feel like in the last 2-3 years, there'd been so many breaches that I don't think this would be the first time mm-hmm. that people have found out that their data had been stolen. So I think this is more of a continuation of what we've been seeing with Target, with Home Depot, with all the restaurants, the hotels, that pretty much all of our data is in the hands of someone we don't know and obviously don't trust.
Well, let me just stop you there. You're saying just we better get used to this, or at least understand that probably our information is in someone else's hands somewhere.
Somewhere. I mean, when I first heard about this, and the first thing I thought about was, is there anyone left in this country who is not exposed, whether it's Equifax or anything else? You know, children have been exposed through the healthcare breaches already. So, okay, children, you know, college students, there have been several colleges attacks recently. So I'm just going through, and I can't think of a single group of people who may not have already been exposed. So Equifax just seems like a nail in the coffin moment than anything else.
So let me turn to you, Matt. So we don't know who stole this or what they want with this information. And we are talking about things like Social Security numbers, addresses, birth dates, driver's license, anything else we should know?
Well, presumably it was pretty much anything that would appear in a person's credit report that was exposed. And that's an incredibly revealing set of information. It includes things like your address, your employer, information about your income, who you have financial accounts with, and, of course, your payment history.
So what would someone – I mean, this is such a naive question here, but I'll ask it anyway – if someone has stolen that, what do they do with that information, or what could they do with that information?
Well, this is the big mystery. There are a number of possibilities. First of all, the information in a credit report is kind of a roadmap for identity theft. It's the information you need in order to steal someone's identity, to impersonate them, to open new accounts in their name. But it could also be used for other things. It has things like your address. It has information that can, reveal how wealthy you are, whether you're behind on credit. So, it might be useful for a criminal. It could also be useful for, a government intelligence agency that's trying to target particular vulnerable individuals who might have access to sensitive information. We don't know who took it, and we don't know what they plan to do with it, whether they want to sell it or whether they want to use it to some nefarious end.
Famita, how would we know if someone was using this, our personal information, for some nefarious end?
The most obvious one would be if you're suddenly getting bills or statements from places that you haven't opened an account with saying, hey, you know, you owe this bill. So checking your regular bank account, you suddenly see amounts being withdrawn, then you can assume that someone took your information and was able to convince the bank that they really were you. So from a personal consumer standpoint, it would be when you suddenly start receiving bills or, you know, notices that this loan application has been approved. Mm-hmm. All these things would be signs that your information had been abused.
And what is Equifax doing to help? And it's interesting to say they really work for these financial institutions with our data. But what are they doing, Matt, or do we know what they're doing to protect our data?
Well, you know, this is probably the most frustrating part of this whole story. You know, in some sense, a breach like what happened to Equifax is almost inevitable. Breaches.
I'm hearing
like
that from both of you, mm-hmm. So we have to just get used to this, right?
Right. Well, and it's unfortunate, but when you aggregate that kind of data and make it available easily to paying customers, it's, you know, ultimately inevitable that eventually somebody's going to get unauthorized access to it on some kind of large scale. And, you know, what's surprising is, first of all, that we're hearing about it, and second of all, the sheer scale of this. You know, 143 million people is a significant fraction of the active participants in the U.S. economy.
Right.
So, you know, more likely than not, you know, your data, my data, and your listeners' data are all in that. But the fact that that sort of information leaks is, as Fumita said, nothing new. And, you know, the advice to check your credit report, to, you know, look for strange bills that don't make sense, get the free copy of your credit report that you can get periodically through your credit card company and so on. That's good advice, but you should have been following that advice before.
Oh, interesting. But doesn't Equifax need to do something? And I have read about a number of complaints from consumers saying, going there, I'm getting the runaround, I'm not getting the correct information.
Yeah, Equifax has been handling this in, I think it's fair to say, a singularly terrible way. You know, initially, they set up a website where you could sign up to find out if your information had been compromised and get free services. And to do that, you had to waive the right to sue them. And, you know, they ultimately clarified that, but we still don't really know what the status of that free service is. They've occasionally put out bad information to consumers, probably most embarrassingly for Equifax and most harmfully. Their Twitter account a few days ago tweeted a link to a website that Equifax actually didn't operate. It was actually being operated by criminals trying to do identity theft. And when you logged into this website, it would ask you your social security number and your information, and then it would capture that. And that was actually tweeted out by Equifax's own Twitter account. So, you know, I think it's fair to say they've not been handling this as well as they might have.
Fumita, you want to add to that? I'm actually looking at the headline to the article that Matt just referenced. Someone made a fake Equifax site, then Equifax linked to it. Has Equifax, from your perspective, like Matt said, been doing a terrible job?
I mean, the thing that amazes me, we're talking about one of the three largest credit bureaus in the country, and this entire response from the moment they disclosed that, okay, this is what's happening, and to even now, it feels like this kind of a breach is something they had no idea would ever happen. They seem very unprepared. So everything seems to be, oh, yeah, this sounds good, let's try it, and not a well-thought-out response, which as a consumer is a very frightening thing to see because you're sitting here thinking you have all my data and I cannot trust you right now to do the right thing.
Wow.
I cannot trust that you know what you're doing. So it's a very amateur hour right now.
And apparently it took them 6 weeks from the discovery of this breach to going public about it, Fumita. Does that concern you? Does that matter?
It takes a while for breaches to be discovered. It's not a good thing. It's a very sad state of the industry that it takes a while. fact that it took 6 weeks itself on its own doesn't bother me. I mean, I wish it had been faster.
Sure.
But it does bother me that even with all this knowledge that they're handling this so poorly, you would think that by the time they discovered it, there would have been safeguards in place so that they're handling and they're responding and they're communicating as transparently as possible. And there are just so many other things going on. You know, we're not sure if we had executives who knew about it and sold stock. So all these other things that's popping up really make that 6 weeks sound even more damning than it might otherwise have been.
And there is a whole other question about selling stocks and when executives knew or didn't know about the breach. I just heard you made a reference to that, Fahmida Rashid. She's senior writer at CSO, focusing on the information security beat, also with us, Matt Blaze. And he's an associate professor for computer and information science at the University of Pennsylvania. And his research focuses on cryptography and secure systems design, talking about what a lot of people are talking about, the breach of Equifax. And you can join our conversation, a lot of people here, at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read an email from Dave. He says, the credit reporting agencies are totally unaccountable. Even months after the hack, the company can't even tell me for sure whether my information was compromised. Where is the accountability? Matt, picking up on what you just said there. A tweet from Brett, Equifax, exponentially more damaging and different than prior breaches of things like credit cards. Would you agree with that? I mean, a credit card is one thing. This is many things.
Well, I think what's different here is the scale. You know, 143 million apparently complete credit reports. But, you know, again, it's Equifax deserves an enormous amount of criticism, but it would be a mistake to focus solely on that. You know, in a large sense, the existence of credit reporting agencies that are aggregating that much data and putting them in one place and making it available so widely is itself the vulnerability. And, you know, the fact that they happen to have a data breach, you know, is ultimately kind of a predictable outcome of a business model that lends itself to this.
But it sounds like you're saying it's really up to us, the consumers, to figure out how to protect ourselves. Is that what you're saying?
The consumers and the regulators. I mean, my hope against hope, and I think this is a long shot, is that the fact that, you know, 143 million Social Security numbers have been leaked will help end the practice of using knowledge of your Social Security number as a way of authenticating you and opening a credit account. Now, I'm not terribly optimistic that this will happen, but you know, this is a wake-up call that we need to rethink how we think about things like social security numbers.
That's interesting. I'm glad you raised that. Fahmida, you want to weigh in on that? And I was reading about now calls for a national ID number ID card so that people don't have to use their social security card to have these financial transactions.
I mean, the national ID number was something I thought about and said, okay, we replace one very important number with another one. I mean, identity has always been about different things. It's not just my name, but it's where I live, where my phone number is, and et cetera. And I think we should be making identity a little bit more fragmented so that it is a little harder, that even if one item is stolen, my entire identity is not. So I don't think we should – I really think that, like Matt said, we should be really moving away from using our Social Security number or our last four digits of our Social Security number to verify that I am who I am. But I don't think going to another centralized number is the answer. We should be going to a system where it's a little bit more information. Maybe we're talking about what I have. It's just kind of spreading out the information so that it's harder.
And when
I
you
mean,
say
I live in New York City, we have multiple locks on our doors. So that one lock is broken, the other one is still there. That kind of thing.
Well, are you talking about things like passwords and sort of how we can have a more secure system to protect our information? Are you talking about, as you say, Fahmida, spreading it around fragmented information?
I think a mix of both. There are some places where a password is useful. Other places, if it's a face-to-face transaction, maybe something like a biometric, some other piece that only I will have that isn't as easy to steal. I think it's just a matter of we have the technology. I think it's now more of a policy and regulatory position to try to put all the different pieces together. It takes away convenience and speed, but I think we're realizing that having everything in one place is no longer the answer.
Would you agree with that, Matt?
Yeah, and as Fumita points out, this isn't, there's no simple fix to this. There's a reason that almost everybody you do business with likes to use your social security number to identify you, and that's because it's easy and cheap, and if you forget what your password is, they can use that to easily reset your account. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that, once your social security number leaks, other people can impersonate you very easily. And, we have to kind of understand this in a more nuanced way on a case-by-case basis. And, if there's any silver lining to the Equifax breach, and there really aren't very many silver linings to it, it's that it's bringing attention to, what's been a serious problem for a while.
Well, let's take a very short break. We have a lot of people that want to join the conversation, and we will get them in on this conversation after this very short break. We are talking about the Equifax breach and what we all need to know about how to secure information about us online. Matt Blaze, again, Associate Professor of Computer and Information Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Fumita Rashid, a senior writer for CSO, focusing on the information security beat. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. We will take your calls after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marnie Moss-Cohen. Let me get, looks like Almond from Richmond, Virginia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And a very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
I think your guest just started talking about this very topic. And my simple question is, why are we still relying on the social security number as a means of identity and authentication, where most of the rest of the world has moved to, other forms, biometric and what have you? I mean, aren't we past due on retiring this as a means of, identity?
Right.
Thank you.
It's a fair question. We touched on it. Can you say something, Matt, back to Amin?
Well,
why do we still continue to rely on social security numbers?
Yeah, the United States is often, as technologically advanced as it is, has been behind almost every other industrialized country in rolling out new security technologies. We were the last country to get chip cards on credit cards and stop using mag stripes, and we still don't have chip and PIN credit cards. And, the reason for this is partly that the companies that are doing this are making cost-benefit decisions based on the risks that they have. And, from the perspective of some company using your social security number to identify you, they're looking at, what does it cost them when they mistakenly allow somebody to impersonate one of their customers? And, what would it cost them to roll out a system that would be more robust, and they make a decision that, this is kind of good enough for them. But what that doesn't take into account is the enormous inconvenience to the customer.
Absolutely.
It's been pointed out many times, we're not the customers of Equifax. We're the product. We don't do business with them. They don't collect money from us. Their customers are the financial institutions that use the reports. And so we don't have a lot of leverage in trying to get them to protect our data better.
Well, and that puts the ball in the court of the regulators, I guess, in Congress. I'm going to save that for a whole other show. Let me get Deborah from Chester County to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Deborah. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. I solicited a credit report from one of the other two companies some years back, So am I still, should I still be worried about this breach? Does it affect the other information the other two companies have?
Deborah, I'm going to toss that to Fahmida. Can you respond to that, Fahmida?
Well, one of the things is each of the credit bureaus have their own set of security measures. So just because one was breached, the other one may not, that's not the case. So we kind of need to be vigilant about any other breaches from others. I mean, Experian, the other one, I think 2 or 3 years ago, one mm-hmm. of their subsidiaries was breached with a lot of data exposed. So, I mean, that's always going to be a risk. The idea about getting your report and data from the other agency, that should be done periodically. I mean, we're talking every quarter or at least once a year. So if it's a check you've done a couple of years ago, you should definitely be doing it again now.
Just for your own peace of mind, I guess. So, Deborah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me read an email from Nick. He says, these credit rating companies get personal credit data wrong, which is nearly impossible to fix, and they have zero accountability for their poor performance. Matt, picking up a bit on what you were just saying there, I think, several embedded questions in there, which is, how do you fix something that's wrong? And is there too much reliance on algorithms? It was one of the articles I was reading in preparation for the show, that the algorithms create the scoring system and that there could be some need for human interference.
Right.
Yes,
so,
no?
So it's important to remember this. The credit companies give a credit score called, you know, a FAIR, ISIC, and FICO score that's based on the information in your credit report, and it kind of gives this single digit about your credit worthiness. It's only as good as the underlying data, and we can argue about how good it is even if the data is perfect. You know, can you really be characterized by a single number?
Right.
But that's a large separate problem that's, you know, probably beyond what we can talk about here. What the data breach tells us is that underlying data is at risk. In order to create a credit score, this information about you has to be aggregated in one place. And once it's aggregated in one place at scale, it becomes a very attractive target for people to try to breach it and use it. And so this was sort of inevitable.
Let me put this to you, Fahmida. I know you wrote an article. This goes back maybe 5 years, but it looks like facial recognition is here, certainly with the new Apple phone that was debuted last week. What do you think about facial recognition as a form of security?
I am very nervous whenever people talk about, this is going to solve all security problems. I think facial recognition had its place. I wouldn't consider it the perfect recognition. I wouldn't consider it a perfect security tool. There are places where I like the idea because it definitely means people are going to be more likely to use it because it might be easier than their fingerprint. But on the other hand, I can see potential for abuse, pretty much any security mechanism can.
How do you see it, Matt?
So I'm interested in the new iPhone facial recognition system. And, you know, I share Fahmida's skepticism about mm-hmm. biometrics as a panacea for all our security problems. But, you know, it certainly does have its place in individual applications. For something like unlocking a phone, if it's done well, and we haven't really seen them out yet, we don't know if it's done well. Apple tends to do things well, but they might not have, then it could actually be quite a useful thing. I have some questions. What if somebody grabs my phone and points it at me and unlocks it that way? That might be a threat for some people. But, I think we have to take a careful wait-and-see approach, analyze it carefully, and understand what its limitations are.
But it seems like this is the future. I mean, that there will be much more use of facial recognition for security purposes.
Probably. I mean, in some areas, it seems useful. For something like unlocking a phone, for something where you're in close proximity to whatever it is that wants to authenticate you and you can't easily be spoofed, then this might be as useful as passwords or fingerprints or any of the other authenticators that we use. But it's not going to replace social security numbers.
I got you. Do you like fingerprints? I mean, is that is uniquely ours, right?
Well, it's somewhat uniquely ours. It's probabilistically uniquely ours. And it's probably good enough for unlocking a phone over short periods of time, but it's probably not what I'd want to use for the door lock on my home.
Oh, interesting. Let me get Beth from, looks like Bethlehem, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I have a comment about human error in this situation. With all the safeguards we can put on our Social Security number, what it comes down to is whether or not people are checking things. My husband was born in the same hospital 2 years prior to a man who has the same name as him. When he was in college, the sheriff's department knocked on his door to arrest him. They didn't check that the Social Security numbers didn't match. And for 25 years of marriage, once a year, we look at our credit report and our histories are completely interwoven. We can't go to an emergency room or a hospital without someone asking us if we live in a city different than ours. In fact, 2 weeks ago, I started getting well-being checkup calls from the hospital saying, you know, how was your surgery? My husband didn't have surgery.
Oh, wow.
And then a week later, we got the hospital bill. So someone is not even punching in or checking or making sure that the identity is correct beyond date of birth. What can we do about that?
Well,
no one's getting it right.
That's such an interesting question. I don't know, Famita, can you help Beth out?
One of those where it's the entire system is failing at this point. I mean, you're obviously working with individual hospitals, et cetera. It's the entire system. And at this point, I would say that for your specific situation, I would actually see if there's the way to get a police report or something so that there's a documented trail that this is an ongoing problem. As Matt was saying earlier, until we see a change in how the entire system of identity is even perceived and used, I don't think there is going to be a way to build in accountability or even ways to fix it. I think that's the biggest problem of the entire system, is that there really isn't an amendment or appeal process.
What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, once you're a victim of identity theft, whether deliberate or accidental, I'd sympathize with the caller. It sounds like a kind of nightmare situation.
How do you undo that, right?
It's very hard, and it's going to require you to keep track of this, you know, for years and years and years, and it can keep coming back. The most frustrating part of this is that the people responsible for this, you know, in the case of the latest breach, Equifax, you know, they're not really bearing the significant human cost of people who get inconvenienced by negligence and data breaches. So, you know, our system of incentives isn't set up to prevent this.
You know what, Famita, we're going to call you back and see if we can get you on a better phone line. We're getting some hit and misses when we're hearing your answers, so we're going to call you back. Let me read an email from Gary. It says, does your guest know if Equifax encrypted all personal data on their servers? If not, why not? By scrambling the data using key-based encryption, the hackers would have had to be pros or hackers just to see what this was all about. What do you think about that, Matt?
So, you know, I study encryption, and, you know, encryption has a very important place in information security. Unfortunately, this is not one of the cases where it's likely to have helped all that much because the data has to be able to be unencrypted on the places where it was stolen.
Wow.
This was stolen off of the servers that process the unencrypted version of the credit reports. And so that server, by design, has to have the encryption keys required to decrypt it. So even if it had been encrypted, the attackers would have been able to get the keys and the unencrypted data from the way they managed to get in. So it's an important thing to do. It wouldn't have helped here.
And we're talking about Apache Struts. Is that the open source software?
Well, there was some software running on the web server that seems to have been a vulnerability, one of the possibly more than one vulnerabilities that the attackers exploited. Software is complex. Software has vulnerabilities in it that are that get patched when they are discovered. Apparently, Equifax was running an unpatched version of the software with some old vulnerabilities in it, and someone took advantage of that.
An email from Susan: does Equifax collect information on everybody? I mean, we're talking about 143 million people. It's a lot of people. It's not everybody, but what do you think, Matt? Well, and then I'll see if we can get Fahmida back.
Basically, you know, the three credit bureaus attempt to collect dossiers on everyone who's participating in the economy. As soon as you open a bank account, get a job, apply for a credit card, get a mortgage, or have any kind of public record about you, you are fair game as far as they're concerned for inclusion in their database. So, you know, it's not everyone. It's just everyone who participates in any way in the economy.
Fahmida, do we have you? Doesn't sound like we do. All right, we need to try to get her on a better phone line, if that's possible. I had a question about ransomware, and we hear about ransoms that are carried out online. What do we need to know about that, Matt?
Well, basically, ransomware is a type of computer attack that attempts to get into your computer, encrypt your files using a key that they don't tell you, and then sends you a message saying, you know, send a few hundred dollars to this address and we'll send you the keys and you'll get your files back. And, you know, basically, there are two defenses against ransomware. One is to make sure that your computer is up to date and running patched versions of software, of all the software you're using. And that's boring and tedious advice, but it's very important for anybody with any kind of computer system that's online. And the other, and again, this is boring and tedious, but very important, is to make backups of your important data. You should periodically, every day or so, be connecting your computer to a disk drive and making a backup of all your important files. You should also brush your teeth and floss after every meal.
Which is kind of boring as well. Right. Just one quick thing. This research firm that we quoted from, most Americans concerned about the Equifax breach, but at least as of a couple of days ago, only 19% had done anything to protect their data. Is it because it's boring?
It's boring. And, you know, on the other hand, in defense of the other 81%, it's not clear that there's anything new that you should do in response to the Equifax breach that you shouldn't have been doing before. A panicked response to this is almost certainly going to get you into more trouble than you were in already. We've already seen even Equifax has been linking to sites that will steal your identity. So you be careful, don't panic, but monitor your credit information.
Well, that seems like the perfect note to end our conversation. Matt Blaze, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
A pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Fahmida Rashid joining us as well. She's a senior writer at CSO. Matt Blaze, associate professor for computer and information science at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.